This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everybody. This is a beautiful day, and it's a beautiful place. And it is another unique opportunity to investigate the great matter, to ask our innermost deep questions. To bring forth the way-seeking mind, bodhicitta, the mind that wants to know what is going on here. What are we doing? I think that's the maybe one common dominator that brings us here, that we come here and sit together. There's a very nice little story in the Upanishads that points out that we are all quite special beings, highly evolved spiritual beings, you could say. And it starts out by stating that that in this vast universe, it's very rare to take on physical form. That actually it's very, very precious and rare that the circumstances are such that actually it condensates or manifests in matter. Of course, we know more than they did back then, and science confirms that. You probably all know that, but if we would take our our galaxy, our Milky Way galaxy, and reduce it to a size of a coconut, or the next galaxy would be about 10 miles away. And in between, there's just empty space, nothing. And I just recently read, if you could go all the way down to the subatomic level, very similar proportions. So basically, there's nothing, and then there's these tiny, tiny little places where somehow the energy condenses enough that there's material. Then the story goes on, and among all these material things, it's very, very rare that life appears. Life in the form that we know it. Probably it does exist somewhere else, but as far as we know it now, we haven't found yet another. And we can look pretty closely and pretty far away by now. So it's very rare to be born in this biological universe. And then again, within that world of organic, growing, living things, it is very rare to become a human being. We are, I don't know, 0.001 or something. Then it goes on saying that, and it's rather rare that among the human beings, we get in contact with the way-seeking mind, with bodhicitta, that we actually somehow stumble upon this option, this possibility of liberation, of the Dharma. And then he goes even further on and says, and of all of those who hear about it or somehow know about it, very few actually make the effort to try and pursue that. Well, here we are. We are all already in that very rare, special position where we actually try our best to manifest the Dharma, to step in that direction, make steps in that direction. And then there's a final sentence in that little story, which is it says, and very few of those actually get to dance. Or I would say that rarely do we get to really dance. Rarely, even though we try very hard. As Rilke says in one of his more famous poems, we feel the Gegenwind, we feel the wind that comes against us, or we feel the resistance mostly. But in our best moments, and I trust everybody knows that, sometimes we actually get to dance, to be one with the great mysterious flow of things, and yesterday we had a ceremony here, a Chukai ceremony for Elizabeth. And she received the precepts and took refuge in Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. This is always a very joyous occasion if that happens and somebody is willing to pick up this particular form of trying to manifest the great matter. It is also like we have to sometimes put up something in our life to stop us. We are so in the habit of taking things for granted that we forget how special the opportunity is, how special our existence is, how mysterious our existence is. We get, you know, even bored and annoyed with it. But this is, it doesn't take too much to realize that this is very unusual, that we are born with this consciousness and have an opportunity to actually look deeply into what it is, what it could be. Certainly, an intellectual understanding is necessary and helpful, and study is a good thing to do, and we have a mind that wants to know. But we also know the limitations of it, that it is our intellect is an important but a very small section of the whole picture. Meditation is a meditation is sort of the, you know, in these Indian temples they have the lingam and the yoni, the male and the female. And meditation is the yoni, is the female aspect of it, where we receive, where we listen, where we listen deeply into ourselves. We do not act. That's the part of the lingam. In some ways, we enter this world of time and space as beings. We enter it. We are the lingam. And there's another side in us that has to receive that. And they perfectly balance each other, have to go together. It's like breathing in and breathing out. We cannot just breathe in or we cannot just breathe out. We have to go into the world, do things, cause troubles, and come back, receive it, sort of digest it, feel it, listen it. So this is a very beautiful and ancient practice, this sitting down and stopping for a minute. And if we are practiced a little bit in doing it, like I'm a totally active person, so I needed some kind of formality to be able to stop. To say, okay, now I do meditation. I sit down and I can ring a bell and I put on some special clothes and then I actually can do this. But really, what it is not doing anything. And with a little practice in, we can do that throughout the day, to stop for one or two breaths, breathing in and breathing out, coming back to how I feel, where am I, where is my body, where is my mind. Have a short appreciation of my existence in this magic, mysterious world. Somehow we are created, we come into this world, we create ourselves, and then we pass on. We die. There's another story that I like a lot, also again in the Upanishad, where... No, not in the Upanishad. Wrong. In our tradition, where somebody comes to the Buddha, and he comes from a far away country where there are wild barbarians, never heard of the Dharma. And so he goes to the Buddha after he has been studying for a while and says, "May I leave and go back home to my folks and tell them about this wonderful practice. Bring them the Dharma." And the Buddha says, "Well, when you bring them the Dharma, and instead of being grateful and thanking you and bowing to you, they laugh at you. What do you do? What do you think?" And he says, "Well, if they laugh at me, I think they are very good people. At least they don't hit me." So of course he says, "Well, and how would you feel if they hit you? Punch you?" Then he says, "Well, then I would think they are wonderful people, because at least they don't throw stones and rocks at me." So he says, "And what if they do throw stones and rocks at you?" He said, "Well, then I think they are wonderful people. At least they don't hurt me with weapons and threaten to kill me." So he says, "Well, and what about if they do use weapons and hurt you, injure you?" Then he says, "Well, then at least I think they are great people, wonderful people, because at least they don't kill me." And then he says, "Well, and what if they do kill you?" And then he says, "Then I think they are wonderful people, great people, to alleviate me or take me out of this valley of suffering, of woe." And the Buddha says, "Truly you are ready to go and bring the Dharma." If we can keep that kind of friendly, supportive mind in the worst of in all circumstances. This is our aspiration. Always missing it, of course, but this is our aspiration where we want to go. Of course, sometimes we have to fix the wrong that has been happening or is happening in the world. Very important. We have to. But as practitioners, our main aim is to be helpful, to be supportive. Trungpa once said, spiritual practice is a constant insult to the ego. When I was thinking this morning, doing Zazen, what I should say, I always want to speak from my heart and what is in my life and what is going on with me to share with you. And several people have asked me and to say something about my involvement with psychedelics. I'm always a little bit torn because it has a tendency to separate the Sangha. Some people feel, they ask me, they feel finally good, talk about it, please. And some others feel this is not really the place to talk about it. So I apologize, and bringing disharmony to the Sangha is one of the grave ranks all the way up there with killing your parents and so forth. So we have to be careful, doubly careful. But since it has played such a central role in my life, I think I just spent 5 or 10 minutes talking about it. It has brought me to this path, and in that respect, I'm a total typical representative of a whole generation, the hippie generation. There was a poll by the Tricycle magazine, it's 20 years back, but and in that poll, over 80% of the now practicing Buddhists indicated that they had some experience, some contact with psychedelics before coming to the Buddhist practice. Well, that's a high percentage. After bringing me to this practice, I was totally abstinent for more than 25 years. I didn't take anything short of some green tea occasionally. But I knew sooner or later I had to go back and look into it because it was so important to me. And I did, and I went into it with a very clear question. Is that something that maybe can be valuable in this mind training, in this what we do, that I formally teach. And in order to pursue that question more deeply, I actually organized a study, a legal study, together with the University of Zurich, where we sat a 7-day sesshin, 6-day sesshin, and on the fourth day of it, half of the people got a fairly high dose of psilocybin, which is the ingredients of the mushroom, and the other half got placebo. And we put people, it was very scientific, put them in the MRI before and afterwards, and they're hooked up on electrodes and had to fill out a lot of questionnaires. Some similar studies are going on in the John Hopkins University. They have been doing in a slightly different way. They have individual settings, not a group setting, where they measure mystical experiences, how you can, different doses, how what it does. And so I always say I misused the science to do that study. For me, it was more a simple question. I wanted to ask, so the ideal participants were very experienced as possible in meditation, and no experience with psychedelics. Well, we couldn't quite get 40 people that were, on the one hand, experienced in meditation, and on the other hand, willing to go through that. I'm sure there are a lot of people that had no experience and they just weren't interested or didn't qualify or whatever. But we got about 25 out of the 40 that actually have no experience with psychedelics. And the other 15 were a little bit experienced, or it was a long time ago or something like that. Well, embarrassingly enough, all 40 out of them, we did it, the whole thing actually 4 times because we couldn't, for technical reasons, ultimately everybody ended up getting psilocybin. Out of the 40 people, all 40, not a single one, reported bad things about it. All of them felt that this was a helpful experience, ranking from interesting and helpful to total breakthrough after 30 years of sitting, a totally renewal of the intention none of them said that it replaces meditation. None of them said it replaces meditation. And I really come over the years now, this has been 5 years back, I'm really very interested in the combination of these two very ancient practices, very ancient technologies of consciousness, you could say. Potentially, the writer of the Yoga Sutras, about one places him or in the same area as Buddha, 2,500 years maybe. He says, you know, the cities, the wonderful states, are either spontaneous, obviously they happen, sometimes spontaneous, and the next one is already, they happen through the sacred medicinal plants. And then it goes on through ascetic practices, through mantras, through meditation, and so forth. So the combination of these two seem particularly promising. And like in the John Hopkins study, the two major differences were that we had a group setting which everybody felt very supportive, very important, and that's one of the setting is one of the three jewels of the psychedelic movement. setting and the substance and the dosage, of course. And the other difference was, of course, that these were experienced meditators. So in the John Hopkins study, about a third of the people who had these experiences also indicated passages of strong confusion or fear. None of them lasted, and they all went through it and came out fine and who had a positive experience. But in our study, there wasn't a single person reporting serious fear or confusion. The structure seemed to carry so well the depth and the intensity of the experience. The idea to me came when I participated in a Native American church ceremony, a peyote ceremony, where things are very regulated. They are so clearly regulated that it reminded me of a sesshin. You don't just get up and walk out, but there's a certain way to get up and how to get out and when you get out. And so, that almost feels like a sesshin. Now, this wouldn't fit everybody who is not familiar with the sesshin, but for those of us who this is sort of second nature, this is a very comfortable, reassuring container. And of course, it is also, I really believe, at the root of our spiritual practice, all the religions anyway. You know, in our particular one, you know, we come out of the Indian Hindu culture, and the oldest parts of the Rig Vedas are the oldest parts of the Vedas. There's this soma mentioned over and over, 120 times. It's the soma that when they wanted to get in contact again with the gods or the ultimate, they drank this soma. Nobody knows exactly what it was, but quite obviously it is something that they drank. And the other side of our culture, of course, is the Greek culture, where they had this mysterious place, at Eleusis, where they drank the kikion. For 1,500 years, that tradition was going on until it was destroyed by the newly Christianized Romans in the 4th century. And they had a 3-week ritual of building up the momentum, and then the final was night. They were going underground and very clearly drank some portion that had something to do probably with the air god that was from the grains. I've used up even a bit more than 5-10 minutes of psychedelics. So the other thing I want to bring up, and then maybe we have a little time still for questions, or if you have a discussion, is a look at our world. You know, our practice is to look deeply into our own mystery, but we have to also breathe out. We have to look at our world, and I think most of us, some more, some less, are concerned of what is going on in this world. And I'm just reading Harari. Some of you may know it. Him, he's a historian. His very best-selling books, Short History of Humankind and Homo Deus, and now I'm reading his third one that just came out last year, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. He's an interesting guy, fairly young, from my perspective, 44 or 5. He meditates. He dedicated his second book to Guenka. He meditates every day, he says, and he's vegan. And very puts things together in a very nice way. And the three things he sort of puts out there as something that we, as humanity, have to look at, and we have to look at from a global perspective, because none of the individual or nation states can do anything individually about it. Is he says, well, there's still the nuclear threat that we almost have forgotten, because it has been, nothing happened for so long. But when it first came, we were all very worried, and but somehow we managed to keep it in a balance, and probably did help to avoid bigger wars, because everybody knew this is so crazy and so potent, and we can destroy each other like that. Nevertheless, the threat is still there. All these nuclear heads are still around, and so this is something we should not totally lose sight of. The other one is the ecological threat that we are faced with. And the threat of the ecological base of our being, of our living, is a somewhat intact system, biological system. And the humans, we have become a factor in that, changing it so quick that it is a real threat. And of course the equation is the impact is the number of people that are on this planet multiplied by the way we consume and live. Both are, people usually have a hard time, they do not want to hear that the number of people is absolutely a problem. And I sort of bumped my head just about, it's about as taboo as drugs in society to say that we are too many people, that we have become a cancerous growth on this planet. I will spare you too many numbers, but every day there are 200,000 more people on this planet. 200,000 people is a lot of people every day that have to be fed and dressed and housed and somehow educated. In a limited world, that kind of growth is just simply not possible, not sustainable. And of course, the other one is the consumerism that we... And among that, actually, the main factor and the main thing that every individual of us can do is that we steer away from too much animal-based food. Plant-based food is much, 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 much less, has less impact than all the meat and dairy that we eat. Beside that it is unhealthy, and beside that it is very cruel, the way we raise it. In a balanced way, it would be totally okay, of course, in this big feast of eat and being eaten. It's totally okay to the way that we did it for hundreds of thousand years. But as we do it now, it has gone out of control. We raise these sentient beings in a most terrible way. And it is the one thing that everybody can do every day. You know, it's very hard to We have to do everything. We have to turn off the lights when we go out, and we have to turn off the water when we brush our teeth. That is very important. But by far the most effective is to steer towards a more plant-based diet. It doesn't have to be black and white, but the direction. And to the end of my talk, I want to give you actually two little stories. One, they're both. One is from an Italian biologist. She describes what happens to a caterpillar that cocoons him or herself. And you know, a caterpillar is a very greedy animal, eats all the time, gets fat. And then it starts cocooning itself. It's not outside influence, but it's doing it that to himself. And so that is in some way similar to our situation. If there's not a comet coming threatening us, but we are the main source. So then some panic starts inside the cocoon, and the immune system tries to avoid the disintegration of the caterpillar, but the caterpillar disintegrates. It's total catastrophe for the caterpillar. And of course it doesn't have any chance, it just deteriorates. And it's not that the eyes of the caterpillar become the eyes of the butterfly, but it totally goes into a soup of cells. And then somehow, miraculously, it starts to rearrange itself. There are little centers at various points, at various places, that start to rearrange this soup into a new form. And I always hope that Jikochi and these kind of places are one of these little centers where there's a totally new kind of something happening. And then, of course, ultimately, this beautiful butterfly flies comes out of it. So even though we don't know, and even though sometimes things really look bad and threatening, and we still have to do our part as good as we can to trusting somehow this process, trusting this life process. It's bigger than we are, and we are not going to destroy it. It's life is bigger than what we can destroy. Thanks God. We can destroy ourselves. That power we have. But life goes on. There's no need to worry about that. And we just have to contribute as good as we can. And this is the last little story I tell you about. One of our ancestors was called the bird nest master. He lived in a tree for, I think, over 20 years. And one day he was visited by the governor of the province, poet, governor, Buddhist scholar, who traveled to visit him and says, "Hey, you up there, isn't that dangerous up there in the tree?" And so the master says, "You are in a much more dangerous position than I am." He says, "How come?" He says, "Well, I'm the governor, and what is so dangerous about it?" He says, "Well, then you don't know yourself very well. Raging passions and the unsteady mind are really dangerous." So he says, "Well, okay. Well, what is the most important thing in Buddhism?" And the bird master quotes from the Dhammapada. He says, "Avoid all evil, do all good, and keep clarifying the mind. That is the teaching of all the ancient Buddhas." So the governor was a little bit disappointed and said, "Well, every five-year-old child knows that." He says, so the master says, "Every five-year-old child may not know that, but even an old man of 80, it's very hard for, and I have to try anew every day." So we need each other to encourage each other to try again every day to make the effort. Mm-hmm. Simple as it is, we all know all that we need to know, but we have to do it. So, thank you very much. Is there time for questions, or do we?
I want to say thank you for bringing up psychedelics and a potentially dividing topic or a controversial topic. In this part of the world, there is a lot of conversation about that. And I think the general sentiment is that psychedelics will be legalized relatively soon, just like marijuana was. And I want to mention for people who are interested, there's a small conference about this in San Francisco in May 17th through 18th. At the Mission Bay Conference Center. And it's basically about exactly what you talked about. It's psychedelics, technology, and meditation. Hmm. So I hope you would be there. I think these are conversations that need to be had.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, it is, as you say, it's probably going to be those are prescribable medicines they will be. I think the first one will be MDMA in the connection of dramatized post-traumatic stress disorder, and psilocybin is being tested and in the process of becoming for depression. And we have a study going right now in Switzerland for fear of death and existential fear, and that's done with LSD. So these are, because in order to get it into a prescription drug, you have to specify very clearly. But it's, of course, I think this is sort of in some ways arbitrary where you can say to which one.
With regard to the psychedelics, could you identify specifically what you see as essential to avoid catastrophic experiences? Mm-hmm. I believe that would include things like the setting, the support, the preparation, I understand, and the dosage. But your comments, please.
You basically mentioned the three essential points to pay attention to. Those, as I said, these are like, I call them the three treasures of the psychedelic path. Is the what you take, what kind of substance, in what dosage, that's goes with the substance. That's very essential. That's very essential. As Paracelsus said, the difference between poison and medicine is the dosage. So, and depending on who it is and what you want to achieve, it's very crucial that you take the right amount, as in any other treatment that you use medicine. And then the second one is the dose, substance, or medicine. The second one is the set, what your mindset is, where you come from, what your intentions are, why do you take it. And there are definitely cases where it's not suggested, where your mindset is not a good space where you should do that. These are very powerful substances, not to be played around lightly. They have to be taken seriously and respectfully approached. But just as you don't put somebody into a jet plane and say, go ahead and fly, the likelihood to have crashing is very high, but that doesn't mean that you cannot fly a jet plane. And then, of course, the third is the setting. It's quite a different experience whether you are in a therapeutic setting where you look at some drama that you have or some fear or something, or whether you do it in a religious setting, be it a Native American thing or be it a Sesshin, or whether you do it recreationally. And I think it has also a legitimate place to do it if the circumstances are right and the substance, the medicine is right and the dosage is right. It's a totally unifying. I've been at Burning Man a few times. It's a few years back now, but I actually put up a sendo there. People getting together and hundreds or dozens or hundreds or thousands to dance together for 2 or 3 days, that's a very, very deep, can be a very deep experience that makes you aware of the connectedness of all things. So if these three are carefully paid attention to, in all the studies we have, we have in Switzerland a group of MDs, doctors, they let me be part of it, even though I'm not a doctor, over in existence for over 30 years, no real problem to report, because we pay attention to these. And I, for a while, studied the cases where things went wrong. It was always a grave breach of one of these, somebody's in a bar and has already some drinks and somebody says, I have something interesting. What? That small? That won't do anything. And all of a sudden, they are in a totally different universe and have no idea. And then problems arise, all kinds of problems. So I try to, and thank you for reminding me, I really try to always also point out that there are shadow sides, or there are dangers involved and connected with this kind of practice. Mm-hmm. It's not to be taken lightly, and it's to be approached with utmost care and respect. But then it may yield, and especially if I look at our world that is sort of also under a little time pressure, it may be, it can actually initiate a truly deep experience, which is ultimately an important and healing and experience to see. Was that the lunch bell? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.